Hi, and welcome to this week's reading of the Arts and Leisure section of the Sunday New York Times. I'm Rob Lund. For the next hour, I'll be reading from the April 7th issue. We're going to start with Broadway. The article is Madonna and Barbara Are Fans. Broadway Meet Lem Pica, written by Alexis Solosky. The playwright Carson Kreitzer specializes in difficult women, disparaged women, women who should be better known. But 14 years ago, when a friend suggested the painter Tamara de Lempicka as a potential subject, Kreitzer wasn't initially enthusiastic. The name meant nothing to her. Then, in a used bookstore, a cover with Lempicka's name caught her eye. Flipping through the monograph, image after glossy image, Kreitzer realized that she already knew Lempicka's brash, gleaming work. She had seen it reproduced in Madonna videos and in Van Cleef and Arpels ads. There in that bookstore, she felt compelled to write something as big, bold, and richly colored as the paintings. "Tamara made me a musical writer," Kreitzer, who had never written a musical before, said in a recent phone interview. "She demanded it." After years of development, Lempicka, a bio-musical by Kreitzer, book and lyrics, and Matt Gold with book and music, opens on April 14th at Broadway's Long Acre Theater. It is a work of recuperation, aiming to restore the reputation in life and art of a queer woman and an ambitious painter who has often been undervalued in the art market and beyond. "She wanted everything," Rachel Chavkin, the musical's director, said of her heroine. "She wanted more from life, and ultimately life lost interest in her." When it comes to reclaiming Lempicka, the musical is not alone. A concurrent selling exhibition at Sotheby's, The World of Tamara, a celebration of Lempicka and Art Deco, features several of Lempicka's paintings, including L'Éclat, a portrait of a woman, her hair coiled like strips of film, and New Old Buildings, a sensuous nude backed by skyscrapers. This fall, San Francisco's de Young Museum will host the artist's first major museum retrospective in the United States. Furio Rinaldi, who, along with Joe Mori, is curating the de Young retrospective, believes that now, a century after she began her career, Lempicka's moment has finally arrived. "Someone like Lempicka, who presents a world of assertive women, incredibly empowered, towering, it's an imagination that really speaks to today," he said. Lempicka was born in the 1890s to Polish parents. The precise year and location of that birth are the subject of debate, and according to Marisa de Lempicka, one of Lempicka's great-granddaughters, the family only recently learned that Lempicka's parents were Jews who had converted to Christianity. With her first husband, Tadeusz Lempicka, she fled Russia and arrived in Paris, nearly penniless, in 1918. Painting had always intrigued her, and after a few years of study, she began to exhibit her work. Quickly, she became an in-demand portraitist. Her subjects were often her friends, Lausch, aristocrats, nightclub habitués, lovers of both sexes. She also painted her family, Tadeusz and their daughter Kizette, though rarely in a flattering light. Her style, which she described as clear painting, looks backward to mannerism and forward to futurism and has a high-gloss sheen to it, like the chrome plating of a motor car. "She is just a technically masterful painter," Julian Dawes, the head of Impressionist and Modern Art at Sotheby's, said. "It would be virtually impossible to fake because it is so specific, because she disguises her brush stroke." A book by her daughter Kizette de Lempicka Foxhall quotes Lempicka's own assessment of her style. "It was neat," she said. "It was finished." Contemporary critics called it strange, perverse. She had a predilection for painting women as modern, urban, desiring. In one of her most famous works, Auto Portrait, she paints herself, steely-eyed, wearing a leather helmet and leather gloves, in the driver's seat of a green Bugatti. She knew the power of the shade, of the silhouette, even though her real car was a yellow Renault. "She was one of the first painters that painted women in a powerful way, in an independent way," Marisa de Lempicka said. they are in charge of their lives besides being glamorous and beautiful. Lempicka believed in glamour, curating her own image by way of parties and precisely staged photographs. Her works sold well through the 1930s and even into the 1940s, a period that saw her leave Europe with her second husband, Baron Raoul Kufner, for America. At times, her image and her nickname, the Baroness with the Brush, superseded her art. Tastes changed, as did Lempicka's style, which veered toward abstract expressionism. Her work, old and new, was disfavored for decades, regarded, if it was regarded at all, as kitsch. Her rehabilitation began in 1972 when a Paris gallery organized a celebrated retrospective of her work. It continued after her death in Mexico in 1980. Lempicka, in typically extravagant fashion, asked to have her ashes scattered over the crater of a volcano. She then acquired famous collectors, chiefly Madonna, who used Lempicka's paintings in her videos for Open Your Heart and Vogue, but also Barbara Streisand and Jack Nicholson. Her work inspired several plays, including Tamara, an interactive show about her disastrous attempt to paint the poet Gabrielle D'Annunzio that ran in Los Angeles for nearly a decade and in New York. At auction, her paintings began to draw higher and higher prices, culminating with Portrait of Marjorie Ferry, which sold for $21.2 million in 2020. This dovetails with a resurgence in Art Deco, the movement most closely associated with Lempicka, and with a current vogue for reevaluating women who have been maligned or belittled by the art historical canon. But Lempicka has yet to become a household name, and her historical reputation remains mixed, the paintings too gleaming, too gorgeous to invite serious appraisal. Lempicka has been considered and diminished to a phenomenon pertaining to the Art Deco period, a phenomenon of decoration, of fashion, rather than a great painter and a fantastic draftsperson, Rinaldi said. That problem of decoration, of fashion, applies particularly to the portraits, great works of compressed narrative, in part because they have lent themselves so readily to advertisement, makeup, jewelry, kitchenware, and to the runway. Armani, Max Mara, Ferragamo have all produced Lempicka-inspired collections. Marissa de Lempicka, who oversees her great-grandmother's estate, is purchasing other licensing agreements. Rinaldi said that while the art world venerates male artists, Warhol, Dali, Picasso, who make their way into popular culture, it can judge women harshly. Her success at auction, he said, reinforces the stereotype that she belongs to a taste that is very easy, that is commercial, that is decorative. A goal of the De Young retrospective is to dispel this idea. We don't want to present her as a poster girl for the Art Deco, but rather a serious painter in full command of her process, he said. Marissa de Lempicka, who has lived with the paintings all her life, sees that seriousness too. At first you can think that her paintings are cold, she said, but stand in front of a painting for a while and you will start seeing a lot of depth. Look at the eyes. There's so much soul in the eyes. Strength is there too, and a startling hunger, which is what attracted Kreitzer. This love of a certain lush power in a woman's body really, really grabbed me, she said. Chavkin felt herself drawn to Lempicka's unconventionality and her appetite, describing her as an incredibly devourous woman. Lempicka, she said, was breaking through gender lines in a time when that was welcomed and celebrated to a point and then slammed down. It's undeniable to me that Tamara's spirit and her work have shaped how we think of feminism and female power today. If the retrospective makes a case for her art, the musical is a celebration of her life, which makes a virtue of Lempicka's drive, passion, and resilience. For Eden Espinoza, who has been with the musical since its premiere in Williamstown in 2018, embodying all that isn't easy. I'm just barely tapping into and scratching the surface, she said. In her younger years, Espinoza said, she had long been conditioned to downplay her own hunger and ambition. But that isn't Lempicka's way. To give myself the permission to inhabit the space that she takes up, it's scary, but also exciting, she said. To Espinoza and the musical's other creators, Lempicka has an immediacy. the feeling of an artist finally meeting her moment. They can see her influence on contemporary feminism and on present-day performance art and design. Tamara was definitely ahead of her time, Kreitzer said. I mean, my God, the world was not ready. Considering the musical, the retrospective, the rising auction prices, perhaps the world is ready now. Or Lempicka, in her imagined Bugatti, might still be outracing us. Our next article is on opera. It's entitled Puccini's Butterfly and Turandot, More Than Appropriation, written by Zachary Wolfe. A key relic of the genesis of Giacomo Puccini's two operas set in Asia can be found not in Italy, where both works premiered, nor in China or Japan, where they are set, but, of all places, in Morristown, New Jersey. There, in the Morris Museum's collection of mechanical musical instruments and automata, is a music box from around 1877. During a visit to the museum in 2012, the musicologist W. Anthony Shepard happened upon the box and, listening to it, was surprised to find that it contained melodies present in those Puccini operas, Madama Butterfly from 1904 and Turandot, left unfinished at his death in 1924. Shepard and other scholars came to believe that that box, made in Switzerland, exported to China, returned to Europe, and owned in Italy before it was acquired by the brewing heir and prodigious collector Murtaugh D. Guinness and donated to the Morris Museum, may have been the exact one that Puccini encountered at a friend's home and quoted in his classic works. This plain brown music box is therefore central to the ambivalence that lately surrounds Puccini, Madama Butterfly, and Turandot, and the amorphous label of appropriation that has been applied to both. It reminds us that Puccini, who was always searching to endow his scores with local color, didn't just compose exotic-seeming faux Asian tunes for his operas, but also sought out actual Asian examples. These works are tributes to the curiosity about other cultures, the desire to blend your traditions with others and tell stories about more than just yourself. That is animated art for as long as humans have been making it. When the heart speaks, whether in China or Holland, Puccini wrote to one of his Turandot librettists, it says only one thing, and the outcome is the same for everyone. But the box, with its reed organ that tinklingly plays six Chinese tunes off a cylinder, is a testament, too, to the messiness of cultural borrowing. It is clear, for example, that Puccini had no problem using melodies from China and Japan in his depiction of Chow Chow San, the Japanese protagonist of Madama Butterfly. He was interested in authenticity, but only to a point. He and most of his audience didn't, and still don't, know or care about the specifics of this material, much beyond its being identifiably Oriental. Joseph Kerman, in his influential 1956 book Opera as Drama, lambasted the bogus Orientalism of Turandot that is lacquered over every page of the score. So, what are we to make of Madama Butterfly and Turandot? These two sumptuously dramatic operas remain among the most popular in the world. Both are playing at the Metropolitan Opera this spring. With increased sensitivity in recent years to the dynamics of cross-cultural representation, who gets to tell which stories and how, the works have come under new scrutiny for propagating stale racial tropes and for using musical styles that weren't Puccini's to take. The announcement of an upcoming Opera Philadelphia run of Butterfly seems to apologize for the production's very existence, offering fretful assurances in the very first sentence that the staging illuminates and ultimately transcends harmful stereotypes. Other American companies have anxiously adjusted Butterfly to make it obvious that they are aware of this discourse. Last year, Cincinnati Opera framed the work as the imaginative leap of a video game playing young man, to suggest that both the male lead and Puccini are white men fantasizing about Japan. New Orleans Opera rewrote the ending entirely in an effort to empower the main character, who lives instead of killing herself. Some European productions of Turandot have dispensed with its legendary time setting in favor of starker, tougher, more overtly anti-Orientalist aesthetics. Madama Butterfly, though, is hardly credulous about the power imbalance in the encounter it depicts. a caddish American naval officer, marries Chow Chow San, then swiftly abandons her to go back to his country, returning to Japan 3 years later to take their young son. With the Star Spangled Banner blaring in ironic fanfare near the start, this is an anti-imperialist, even anti-American tragedy. Puccini isn't ambiguous about the relative morality of his heroine and villain. Indeed, he cloaks Pinkerton, the American officer, in the seductive musical armor of the traditional tenor lover, a Rodolfo to Chow Chow San's Mimi, as if to implicate the whole Italian opera genre in the man's grotesque actions. Of course, even sympathetic depictions of cultural others can participate in stereotyping them, and perpetual victimization is its own stereotype. Just because Butterfly shows an Asian woman being betrayed doesn't mean it truly empathizes with her. But in Chow Chow San, there is more than just a reinforcement of the trope of the demure, passively abused geisha. She has, in The Musicologist, Arthur Grues wrote in 2016, a complexity of character unmatched in fin de siècle Italian opera. That complexity emerged from the seriousness with which Puccini approached his work on Butterfly, which was, as Mary Jane Phillips Matz writes in her biography of the composer, so different from everything he had written. After he decided to adapt David Belasco's play Madame Butterfly, which he saw in London in 1900, Puccini researched Japanese music and asked the wife of a Japanese diplomat in Rome for help with sources. He discussed matters of style with the Japanese soprano Tamaki Miura, who would go on to sing over 2,000 performances of Butterfly. The melody of Echigo Jishi, a well-known piece for the koto, a traditional string instrument, was incorporated into the score in the passage when the marriage broker Goro announces the entrance of Chow Chow San and her friends in the first act. It is played by staccato violas, cellos, and bassoons in unison, Grues writes, gesturing toward the plucked strings of the koto and the kabuki accompaniment of shamisen and flute that Puccini had heard when he saw Japanese actress Sadayako perform the piece in Milan in late April 1902. Turandot, based on an ornate 18th-century fairy tale drama by Carlo Gozzi, exists in a wholly different theatrical universe than the Belasco-esque, naturalistic 19th-century melodrama of Butterfly. Its playfully fabulistic setting, a magical rather than realistic Peking, has to be understood to accept what might seem like offensive oddities. A dragon lady protagonist and three court ministers named Ping, Pang, and Pong. But even the haughty, bloodthirsty Princess Turandot explains herself and the painful sources of her rage, and the seemingly interchangeable trio of ministers gets a surprisingly tender, individualized scene at the beginning of Act Two. For the score, Puccini borrows melodies from the Guinness Music Box and at least one other box owned by a family he knew. A source told Phillips Matz that Puccini wrote to Giulio Gatti Casaza, the general manager of the Metropolitan Opera, and a friend, asking him to visit Manhattan's Chinatown and return with musical examples he could use in the opera. Here, and in Butterfly, the result was more sophisticated and moving than standard-issue window-dressing Orientalism. There's far more authentic material in these operas than in, for example, Bizet's Les Pêcheurs de Perles or Delibes' L'Acme, both set in South Asia. The intensity of curiosity in Puccini's two operas comes through, as does their interest in using musical research to create a vision of Asia that included characters whose interiority and intricacy Western audiences would be forced to recognize and empathize with. Puccini's universalism was sincerely felt, even if it's unfashionable today, and it deserves to be appreciated rather than just cynically apologized for, as some opera companies seem to do while continuing to reap the ticket-selling benefits of his popularity. It's helpful to remember that we are dealing here with Italian operas about Asia, not with Asian operas. I think audiences understand this distance, even without specific directorial strategies that emphasize it. But such techniques can be effective. The Met's sleek and lacquer-shiny current production, originally directed by Anthony Minghella, affectingly represents Chow Chow San's son with a bunraku puppet, constantly surrounded by operators draped in black. Something similar will be attempted in the upcoming Opera Philadelphia staging, directed by Ethan Hurd, in which Chow Chow San will be represented by a doll, separate from the soprano. That soprano will be Karen Chow Ling Ho, who is Taiwanese. The doll's puppeteer is Hua Hua Zhang, who was born in Beijing. If Puccini was guilty of conceiving Asianness as a monolith, then he isn't alone. What is so different about a Taiwanese soprano being thought of as right for Butterfly versus Puccini using Chinese melodies in addition to Japanese ones in the score? An interest in such matters is spotty. The accurate representation of Roma people is not a part of most Carmen stagings or casting decisions. I regularly hear from white audience members about their faint embarrassment at watching the glittering explosion that is Franco Zeffirelli's Met production of Turandot, a staging first seen in 1987 that actualizes the fairy tale dream of China that the opera's creators intended. But assuming that the whole thing is ersatz, and therefore more or less unacceptable, may itself be the ignorant position. After all, the production's dances were created by Cheng Qing, described in the New York Times in 1979 as a choreographer who fuses her own Chinese cultural background with the American modern dance currents around her. What's brushed off as appropriation can be a more complicated and interesting story than the one that's told. As I go on reading from the New York Times Arts and Leisure section, the April 7th edition, we will switch to the topic of dance. The writer Brian Siebert gives us, for 50 years, Ailey 2 has been proving ground, not just for dance. Ailey 2, the second company of Alvin Ailey American Dance Theater, turns 50 this year. Since its creation, some things have remained consistent. It has always served as a bridge between student and professional life. It has always been filled with ambitious young people aspiring to join the main troupe. And, as members of every generation agree, the experience has always been demanding, extremely so. "It's a pressure cooker," said Francesca Harper, who's been the artistic director of Ailey 2 since 2021. As has been the norm, the current group, which is performing a 50th anniversary program at the Joyce Theater beginning April 9th, consists of a dozen dancers who stay with the company for two-year terms. Between classes, rehearsals, and an extensive touring schedule that combines performances with lecture demonstrations and master classes, those years are tough. "Alvin often called it a kind of finishing school," said Sylvia Waters, who was the company's artistic director from the beginning until 2012. "It gives them discipline and stamina and teaches them how to take care of themselves." Between Waters and Harper, the company was led by Troy Powell, who was fired in 2020 for engaging in inappropriate communications with adult students at the Ailey School. Training dancers was the goal from the get-go. At the Ailey School in the 1970s, the students were all obsessed, said Sarita Allen, a former Ailey dancer. "We would stay from early morning to late at night. We wanted to live there. Alvin was always around, and we wanted to do our best for him." In 1974, CBS offered Ailey the chance to make a television special celebrating the music of Duke Ellington. But the company was on tour, so he gathered Allen and other students and thought, Allen said, "Maybe I can pass them off as the company." It worked. While Allen joined the main company, many of the other students became the Alvin Ailey Repertory Ensembler, later known as Ailey 2, led by Waters, who had danced with the Ailey Company since 1968. "Our mission was education and outreach," Waters said. "At first, the group performed mostly at senior homes, hospitals, and prisons. These people could not get to performances, so we went to them," she said, echoing Ailey's dictum that dance came from the people and should always be delivered back to the people. Works by Ailey formed the core of the Ailey II repertory, but Waters also commissioned young choreographers, giving them the opportunity to experiment, and the dancers the opportunity to work with choreographers. Some of the most important of them made dances for Ailey II before contributing to the main company. Ulysses Dove, Ronald K. Brown, Kyle Abraham. Jamar Roberts, the company's first resident choreographer, is on that list. So is Robert Battle, Ailey's artistic director from 2011 through last year. All along, Ailey II faced hardship, even tragedy. In 1978, as the dancers were returning from a show in New Jersey, a tractor trailer crashed head-on into their bus. Several dancers were injured and all were traumatized. One, Jean Dijon, died of her injuries. Performances were postponed for many months, and after they resumed, the loss of income created a deficit that took a long time to recoup. "I quivered at the end of every year when we learned what the budget was," Waters said. "Would we continue to exist?" Members of the Ailey board periodically suggested that a second company was a luxury that the organization could not afford. But Alvin, she said, was always very supportive. After a performance in 1979, the agency that booked Ailey engagements suggested that Ailey II could handle the overflow, playing the colleges and small towns that the main troupe had outgrown. Arduous bus and truck tours across the country followed. This raised the bar, Waters said, but better preparing the dancers to be in a professional company. For decades, Ailey II did not tour internationally. The idea, Waters said, was to avoid competing with the main company. In 2008, though, Ailey's booking agent realized that there were many theaters, especially in Europe, that wanted an Ailey performance but could not afford one. So, Ailey II began to perform there and continues to roam widely. The 50th anniversary tour has stopped in England, Italy, and the prestigious Holland Festival abroad, along with places like Luling, Louisiana, and Temple, Texas in the United States. If there's one destination Ailey II dancers have foremost in mind, it's Alvin Ailey American Dance Theater. That isn't an unreasonable goal. Most years, two or three dancers move up, and at least half the members of the main company are alumni of Ailey II. But while the second group is a feeder, promotion isn't guaranteed. Terms in Ailey II are more like a two-year audition, since the director of the first company is often around. "They have the inside track," Waters said. "That often starts at the Ailey School or the Ailey Fordham Bachelor's Program. The Ailey Student Performance Group, sometimes known as Ailey III, was founded in 1984 and has endured in various forms since then. Some of its members graduate into Ailey II. There are also apprentices who learn multiple roles so they can step in when someone is injured. Only since 2021 have apprentices been paid. Ailey II dancers are not unionized, unlike those of the main company, and the Ailey organization does not share information about compensation. Sometimes, advancement is accelerated. That happened to Yannick Lebrun, who was in his second year with Ailey II in 2007, when he was tapped to fill in for an injured dancer in the main company during its New York season. That was essentially his audition, and as soon as his term with Ailey II ended, he moved up, fulfilling the dream that had drawn him from his home in French Guiana. In 2019, he set a work of his own on Ailey II. Not moving up is a disappointment, but not a career-ending one. Ailey II dancers have moved on to companies like Dance Theater of Harlem, the Martha Graham Dance Company, Philadanko, and Ronald K. Brown Evidence, as well as many Broadway shows. Jasmine Guy, who was with Ailey II from 1980 to 1981, fell in love with the Ailey Company the most common way, by seeing its signature work, Revelations. She decided not to audition for the main troupe, and because of her, no other company would do, she shifted into acting, starring in the sitcom A Different World. Her stint with Ailey II was a magical time, she said, that served as a foundation for the rest of her career. "Everything I've done since, I thought, what are you all complaining about?" she said. "On TV, I couldn't believe all the breaks you get. I was used to working a lot harder and longer." When Ephraim Sykes was in Ailey II from 2006 to 2008, he had tunnel vision about joining the main troupe, he said. It didn't happen. But through Daryl Grand Moultrie, a choreographer he had worked with at Ailey, he got an audition for The Little Mermaid on Broadway, the start of a Broadway career that has since included a Tony Award nomination for Ain't Too Proud and the title role in the 2023 Encores revival of Pal Joey. As a dancer suddenly required to act, Sykes leaned into the LA training, he said. At LA, there's always a why and an intention behind every step. I learned how to say something. Like Guy, he also knew about the grind. People are always talking about how hard Broadway is, 8 shows a week, Sykes said. And I'm always like, what are y'all talking about? Still, part of the fun of watching an A-Lee 2 performance is to play talent scout and try to guess which dancers will make it onto the varsity team. Waters said that when time for the main troupe's annual audition approached, all kinds of attitude emerged. She tried to manage expectations with honesty and never told anyone that moving up was a sure thing. Well, only once, and she was wrong. Harper, too, said that there are always surprises, and not just about who is chosen for the first company. Some dancers that I wasn't sure about when I hired them have turned out to be amazing, she said. It's the tenacity. You can see which ones fight for it. Jared Farcon, who is now in his second year with A-Lee 2, or rather his third since he started as an apprentice. Being in the company, while definitely hard, he said, trains you to do anything, Broadway, Radio City, concert dance. He has Broadway in mind, maybe. But really, there is one dream. In a few months, he'll know. Now, the topic is music. The article is Vampire Weekend Did Not Make a Doom and Gloom Record, written by John Pareles. From the first seconds of Vampire Weekend's new album, Only God Was Above Us, it's clear that something has changed. Ice Cream Piano starts with hiss, buzz, feedback, and a hovering, distorted guitar note, the opposite of the clean pop tones that have been the band's hallmark. It's the beginning of an album full of startling changes and wild sonic upheavals, all packed into 10 songs. The new album, like all of Vampire Weekend's work, is meticulous, self-conscious, and awash in musical and verbal allusions, sometimes direct, sometimes cryptic. But it's also a broad pendulum swing from its 2019 release, Father of the Bride, a leisurely jam band-influenced sprawl that ran nearly 58 minutes. Only God Was Above Us, the group's fifth album, due April 5th, is 8 songs and 10 minutes shorter. With every album, we have to push in two directions at once, Ezra Koenig, Vampire Weekend singer and primary songwriter, said in a recent interview. Sometimes that means we have to be poppier and weirder. Maybe with this record, it's about both pushing into true maturity in terms of worldview and attitude, but also pushing back further into playfulness. There's a youthful amateurish, along with some of our most ambitious swings ever. Koenig, age 39, described the new album's sequence of songs as a journey from questioning to acceptance, maybe to surrender, from a kind of negative worldview to something a little deeper. Ultimately, he said, the LP is optimistic. It's not a doom and gloom record, and even if there's songs where the narrator is trying to figure something out or feels confused, that's not all. That's part of the story. It's not the thesis of the album that the world is dark and horrible. The album also exults in musical zingers, non sequiturs, and startling off-grid eruptions. The songs often morph through multiple changes of tempo and texture, rifling unpredictably through indie rock austerity, orchestral lushness, pop perkiness, and hallucinatory electronic studio concoctions, like the cascade of wavery overlapping piano lines in Connect. Where Father of the Bride had a folky openness, Only God Was Above Us is crammed with ideas that gleefully collide. Ever analytical Koenig mused that Vampire Weekend's albums each reflected patron saints. He named Paul Simon for the band's self-titled 2007 debut, Joe Strummer and Sublime for Contra from 2010, Leonard Cohen for Modern Vampires of the City, and The Grateful Dead's Jerry Garcia and Robert Hunter, along with Fish, for Father of the Bride. The new album, he said, may reflect a short-lived tour he didn't get to see, the 1997 pairing of Rage Against the Machine and Wu-Tang Clan, which reached the cover of Rolling Stone. distortion, heaviness, hardness, Koenig said. We were drawn toward those qualities on this record in a more direct way than ever before. Koenig spoke via video from his home in Los Angeles. Behind him, from the collection of his wife, the actress Rashida Jones, was a wall of photographs by the artist Taryn Simon from the Project Contraband, bootleg DVD boxed sets that were confiscated by United States Customs, arrayed in minimalistic formations. Like Vampire Weekend songs, they neatly frame disruptive material. Vampire Weekend has always had two distinct aspects, its fastidious album work and its frisky live shows, and may soon have three. More on that later. The central one is the music the band constructs in the studio, which is minutely tweaked and painstakingly considered. Vampire Weekend songs uphold a long-established tradition of concise pop songwriting, but even as it delineates clear verses and choruses, the band pushes every other parameter. With some types of art, you probably have to put a lot of thought into how to create layers of meaning, Koenig said. Songs are, by their nature, relatively short. They have repetitive hooks. Then if you want to go maximalist and fill it with production details and arrangements, you can. And if you want the lyrics to push out into some weird place, you can. Yet the basic of pop songwriting keep the band's experimentation grounded. You can zig and zag from verse 1 to verse 2 to verse 3, but you keep coming back to the same chorus, he added. But now it's recontextualized by the second verse. I think that all that stuff is built into the format. It's this great populist art form where you can get really out there, but the structure holds it together. Beginning with the 2013 album Modern Vampires of the City, Vampire Weekend's studio output has increasingly been a collaboration between Koenig and the producer and multi-instrumentalist Ariel Rechtschad, who has worked on hits with Madonna, Usher, Haim, and others. I have been part of making things that sound expensive and beautiful, Rechtschad said in a video interview from his Los Angeles studio. But on this record, when the songs were at a certain stage, we were just like, this sounds exciting to us. It wasn't a gimmick. It wasn't like, here's the decision to make something that feels noisy or dirty or distorted. It's that the songs were emoting properly. The band and Rechtschad have been working on and reworking most of the new album's songs since 2020. Two tracks, Gen X Cops and The Surfer, originated much earlier. The untamed slide guitar line of Gen X Cops came from Brooklyn Sessions in 2012, while The Surfer includes much altered elements of a song Koenig had been writing with Rostam Batmanglij, who left Vampire Weekend in 2016. Sometimes you get lucky in the music, the production, the lyrics, and the performance all come together and it fits on the record you're working on, Koenig said. And sometimes you know there's something special about it, but you have to put it aside and just let time do its thing. Although Vampire Weekend's members have settled in Los Angeles, its new album is suffused with thoughts of 20th century New York City. Those were the decades before Vampire Weekend got started at Columbia University in 2006. Weird half-baked memories and pictures and thoughts and family history, Koenig said. That's the version of New York that's floating through this record. The opening tracks ponder conflict and disillusionment. Classical finds bitter power struggles hidden in history, noting how the cruel becomes classical in time. In Connect, the singer wonders, is it strange I can't connect, mingling the personal and the online. The album eventually concludes with Hope, the longest song in Vampire Weekend's catalog, a stately 8-minute litany of disasters and injustices. The sentencing was overturned, the killer freed, the court adjourned. With a guardedly reassuring refrain, I hope you let it go. The album title comes from a New York Daily News headline shown in the album's cover photograph, which was shot by Steven Siegel in 1988 at a subway graveyard inside a subway car turned sideways. An image that looks surreal, but needed no special effects. One song, Mary Boone, borrows the name of the Soho gallery owner who was hugely influential in the 1980s. Another, Prep School Gangsters, is named after a 1996 story in New York Magazine about privileged students dabbling in the drug trade. The prep school gangster, those are the people who run the vast majority of institutions, Koenig said. It's very possible, especially in America, especially in New York, that every now and then the prep school gangster's grandfather was once the disadvantaged youth, and that the disadvantaged youth's grandson will be the prep school gangster. And here they are in this brief moment of time, meeting together. The Surfer begins with a reference to Water Tunnel 3, a project to bring water to New York City from a reservoir in Yonkers. It has been under construction since 1970 and is far from complete. There's that eerie but beautiful feeling that underneath this, the most populous city in America, there is an almost century-long project happening where people are burrowing through the earth, Koenig said. And then, classic New York stuff that everybody wants to talk about, the bagels and the pizza. It's so good because of the water. Where does the water come from? It comes from upstate New York, far away. How does it get into somebody's tap on the Lower East Side? It's always been a slight obsession of mine, he continued. I like that idea about the underground. I don't mean culturally, I mean just literally what's underground. Vampire Weekend will soon be resurfacing to tour, a job far removed from the band's finely detailed studio work. Real-time performing used to be a fraught prospect for such a perfectionist group. I would hear musicians talk about, oh man, you know, touring is tough, but then once you get on stage, all your worries go away and you're just connecting with the audience, Koenig recalled. And I'd think, what are these people talking about? That's when the worries start. For its 2019 tour, Vampire Weekend expanded its stage lineup to 7 musicians and vocalists, opening up more possibilities in the songs and relieving some of the virtuosic pressures. Now, when we get together to rehearse, there's a youthful, playful vibe, Koenig said. We're always coming up with ideas that make us laugh. The full band has been practicing since November for a summer tour it will preview on April 8th, performing a midday concert in Austin in the path of the full solar eclipse and sharing a free live stream. Along with recording and touring, Vampire Weekend may soon unveil a third facet. Chris Baio, the band's bassist, and Chris Thompson, its drummer, did separate video interviews from the studio space they share in Los Angeles, a converted medical office where Vampire Weekend started meeting in summer 2020 for weekly, COVID-distanced jam sessions, playing in separate rooms and recording hundreds of hours of music. The world had stopped working, and a lot of what we normally do was just not being done, Thompson recalled. There was something about just playing with no expectation to just play with my two very close friends without an agenda. Bayo said, it's very rare for people in a band of our size to be alone together. No engineer, no tour manager, nothing like that. It felt like being at the outset of the band again, and we did that for 3 years and change whenever we were all in town. Those sessions may lead to the emergence of a new trio that happens to have the same members as Vampire Weekend, performing unreleased material. We kind of have an imaginary backstory for that band, Koenig added. It was a band that came out around 1989, 1990, and they were a little too punky for the jam scene, a little bit too jammy for the punk scene. And there's a little bit of the Minutemen in there. The truth is, this is very premature because that band is still hashing out its sound. I don't want to say too much. Could the unnamed trio open shows on Vampire Weekend's tour? Well, that has been discussed, Koenig said dryly. We were just trying to create a sound that we've never quite heard before, he had noted earlier. That's what keeps us going. Art and design is our next topic as I go on reading from the April 7th edition of the New York Times Arts and Leisure section. The article is, Her Art is at Odds with Museums and Museums Can't Get Enough, written by Karen Rosenberg, reporting from Denver, Colorado. Inside the Museum of Contemporary Art in Denver, little pieces of Antarctica were melting. Cross-sections of an ice core from the continent's Newell Glacier, each one about the size of a beverage coaster, and encased in a vacuum-sealed plastic bag. The artist Gala Porras Kim watched approvingly during a visit in March, pointing out the air pockets that had started to form. The ice cores are an archive of ancient air, because the air gets stuck in the layers of ice, she said, pointing at the display during an interview at the museum. This particular core, which Porras Kim had obtained from the National Science Foundation's Ice Core facility in nearby Lakewood, Colorado, contained ice that had formed some 10,000 years ago, around the beginning of the Holocene period in geological terms. Porus Kim, an interdisciplinary artist who often questions how museums collect material from previous civilizations, was also planning to debut what she called an ice performance at the opening of her solo exhibition on March 8th, Gala Porus Kim, A Hand in Nature. That night, and at monthly intervals thereafter, an unsealed piece of the core would be placed on a silver tray and allowed to thaw. The ancient air will get released into this room, a reunion of this old air with the new air mixing together, she said, describing it as an organic deaccession process. The exhibition at MCA Denver is the largest museum solo the 39-year-old artist has had in the United States. It follows her busy year of one-person exhibitions at the UCLA Fowler Museum, the Liam Samsung Museum of Art in Seoul, and the Museo Universitario Arte Contemporáneo in Mexico City, among other venues. And next spring, Porus Kim, who is based in Los Angeles and London, will have a solo show at the Carnegie Museum of Art in Pittsburgh. The artist brings a new and refreshing perspective to some of the most important and confounding questions in the field today. How to preserve and display the artifacts of ancient people and indigenous cultures in prominent museums, and whether to keep them at all or engage in a process of restitution. Her art often unfolds through dialogues with directors, curators, and conservators, memorialized in formal letters that suggest ways to restore a sense of spirituality and ritual to objects that have been wrested from their original contexts. In person, she has an upbeat, optimistic way of speaking, conveying a persuasive confidence that museums can correct their troubled histories if they are willing to think more like artists. Often, Porus Kim's arguments are at odds with the museum's imperative to preserve what was taken. One of her projects, Precipitation for an Arid Landscape, proposes that remnants of ceremonial offerings that have been dredged from a sacred cenote at Chichen Itza in Mexico and moved to Harvard's Peabody Museum be rehydrated with rainwater and copal resin because the Mayan god of rain, Xoc, remains their rightful owner. The rain is still around, Porus Kim has said in previous interviews, and who can argue with that logic? The child of two scholars, her Colombian father is an old-school historian and her South Korean mother more postmodern, she said, Porus Kim spent her early years in Bogota, Colombia, and then moved to Spain. Her family eventually settled in Los Angeles, and her mother had enrolled in a PhD program at UCLA, and Porus Kim and her father were able to obtain political asylum. Porus Kim almost followed her parents into academia. After earning a Master of Fine Arts from Cal Arts, she earned another master's degree in Latin American Studies from UCLA. She came back to art because, she said, it encompassed so many other fields. I see museums as a box, a container that is always changing to fit whatever the collection is. The Denver exhibition is unusual for Porus Kim in that the museum has no permanent collection for her to respond to. So she found another kind of collection nearby at the Ice Core facility, where about 25,000 meters of ice are neatly stashed in metal tubes within a giant freezer kept at minus 38 Celsius. About 2,000 meters a year are deaccessioned to make room for new samples. This is how Porus Kim was able to obtain the cores for her exhibition. I have mixed emotions about seeing them melt, the facility's head curator, Kurt LeBombard, said when Porus Kim and I visited the exhibition. But that's the point, reaching a new audience that may not have been exposed to what we're doing in climate science. The last thing we want to do is dispose of these in such a way that they have no value for anybody. At the MCA, several of the works present the carefully controlled museum environment as an illusion. Spores gathered from the storage facilities of the British Museum multiplied on an agar-soaked cloth. Moisture piped across the gallery from a dehumidifier dripped through a graphite-saturated fabric, making an abstract drawing on a panel placed on the floor. Porus Kim also made a site-specific artwork out of a defect in the museum building. The large crack that almost bisects its picture window, which appeared a little over a year ago during a winter marked by extreme fluctuations in temperature. She has titled it Currents Through the Fissure from Controlling Nature, and has placed a bench nearby so that visitors can sit and examine it. The museum is trying to regulate temperature within this box, but the climate doesn't care. The tension between the two is always going to make this crack, she explained as we looked out through the glass to the street below. As with the melting ice cores, which are displayed next to the broken window, she is most interested in the idea of air escaping a container. The title is not so much about the crack, but how the air is coming through, she said. Porous Kim's art can be described as a new variant of institutional critique, the movement associated with 1970s-era works by artists such as Michael Ascher and Hans Hock. These artists were known for calling attention to the physical and social infrastructure of the art world. She studied at Cal Arts with Ascher and credits his radical but intellectually rigorous approach, as well as the highly conceptual and philosophical art of Charles Gaines, another of her teachers, as strong influences on her thinking about historical collections. How do we move from just prioritizing the material when there are some things beyond the material that could be preserved better, she said. You see it easily when you look at conceptual art, which is immaterial. What are the conservation directions for something that is installed in your head? Leilani Lynch, the associate curator at the museum and the organizer of Porous Kim's exhibition, says that she was drawn to the artist's work because it was digging into the ways in which museums operate, but through a voice and a lens that felt distinct from the history of institutional critique. This show, she says, is about zooming out from the microcosm of museum collections to examine values of preservation and conservation and the ways in which we are trying to persist as a civilization. Matthew Robb, a Mesoamerican specialist who organized Porous Kim's exhibition last year at the Fowler Museum, appreciated Porous Kim's willingness to confront institutions on their own terms. Porous Kim's inquiries feel especially apt at a time of increasing self-scrutiny by museums as they navigate calls for restitution and, in the United States, new federal regulations around the display of Native American cultural objects. There's a great deal of anxiety that surrounds institutions, particularly since the pandemic era, the cultural consultant Andres Zanto, the author of a book on the future of museums, said. It makes this kind of work very urgent because museums themselves are feeling their way and trying to arrive at the right balance. For an artist to be part of that conversation, but with nuance and complexity and not just landing the cheap shots, is a very welcome thing. Her suggestions to museum staff, however, are sometimes at odds with the new directives to return objects to their geographic places of origin. Most of the museums I've worked with have a singular Western point of view, Porous Kim said. It's not as simple as saying we can copy-paste backward and just return something. Back at the museum, the ice cores were shrinking in their plastic bags. After a few hours, the pieces were about the diameter of a hockey puck and surrounded by a froth of air bubbles. One of the hardest parts of this has been to let the ice melt, because it hasn't melted in 10,000 years. But it's not about the water. It's about the air, she said. This is a way of thinking about how the air, which we think has no age because it's around us all the time, has been collected and preserved, she told me. There are some things that, once the vapor seal of history is opened, you cannot put them back. And now we have time for Catherine Shattuck's interview with J.B. Smoove. He's been here before. This is almost like an old SNL story, he said, referring to when he lost his writing job on Saturday Night Live in 2006. Something has to go away for something to come in. This time, what's ending is Curb Your Enthusiasm, on which he plays Leon Black, Larry David's foul-mouthed house guest who never left. What's coming in is Smoove season. Larry might be ready to hang them up, he said. I'm ready to take them off. This is my time to introduce all things that I love. Among them, producing and his new lines of watches and hat boxes. In fact, Smoove is still not certain that his 12th and final season of Curb is actually its last. Here are edited excerpts from his conversation. Close dancing. My wife, Shaw, calls me Twinkle Toes. I started in a dance crew when I was younger, and man, I have been dancing my whole life. My wife and I, any event we go to, we are literally the life of the party. We like dirty dancing, we like to do our little moves, and we dance even better when we know people are watching us. JB Smoove likes suits, shoes, and shades. Now, that is the JB look right there. I would wear a suit every day if I could. It forces your posture. You have to purposefully have your suit to the point where you have to breathe in, and then you button your top button, and you don't exhale for the rest of the night. That belly is sticking out. You are not doing that suit justice. JB Smoove likes classic watches. I used to wear a watch that didn't tell the time. The battery ran out. I kept wearing it. You know what that watch did for me? Every time someone looks at my watch and says, your watch isn't working, I say, you know why it's not working? I know what time it is. And that's go time. He also likes cigar cars. I've got a 1968 Lincoln Continental with suicide doors. My personalized plate is 68 Stank. That's one of my jewels of my car collection. I also have a 1963 Studebaker Avanti. I showed Larry a picture of the car. He went crazy. I call them cigar cars. You got to have a cigar in your mouth with a nice brim when you're riding by, and you look good. JB Smoove also likes treating his home like a castle. When you're in a public eye, sometimes you can't go everywhere, so we redid this whole house as an entertainer's home. I have a shuffleboard table, I got a pool table, cornhole, which is as big as pickleball is right now. We built a guest house, we built a pool house, we built a pool. Your home should be your castle. He likes hat tricks, and JB Smoove says, you got to find the right brim, because everybody's face is different. I got a very long face, so I like my brims to be a little longer and a little flatter. And it's got to be a certain height that's going to accentuate my cheekbones and my chin. Sometimes I grow my beard in, but sometimes I like showing my dimple. He has an RV. He says, we have a Thor Damon Outlaw, and that RV is humongous. Going from L.A. to Vegas at night, you can see the stars from the driver's seat. We only do RV resorts. We don't do campgrounds. We a little bougie. Does he like winter? Oh, I love skiing, tubing, snowmobiling. I don't even get sick in the winter. My nose hasn't run in 25 years on a ski trip. Then there is eating vegan, to which JB Smoove says, when I travel, I used to always go to Buffalo Wild Wings, and one day I was tearing the meat apart, and it just didn't get me no more. I said, well, I think I'm over it. So I gave up meat, and it has been an amazing, amazing transformation. My one weakness is sweets. And JB Smoove riffs on exploring. We love all aspects of travel, seeing amazing things that we've never seen before, meeting people from all over the world. It makes you well-rounded. I tell young people all the time to go places. Don't spend your whole life on your neighborhood. Get off the streets, go to college, exchange ideas, exchange your life story with people. It's going to make you an amazing adult. With that, that is this week's reading of the Arts and Leisure section of the Sunday New York Times, the April 7th issue. I'm Rob Lund. Have a great day. Thank you for listening to Chris.